All right, Karen, we're back in the studio. It's been a little bit of a hiatus since our last episode.
I know. It went from Arctic to temperate. It's beautiful outside.
Yeah, our last episode on refrigeration was appropriately recorded when it was about 13 degrees
13.
Or something like that. And now it's how warm?
It's going to be 78 or 79 degrees today. So now's a good day, I think, to talk about how all that refrigeration technology gets integrated into the distribution of food into cities.
Yes,
absolutely. Through rail and truck in the summer.
And so, yeah, this is How Great Cities Are Fed. We talk about the book, How Great Cities Are Fed, which was written by Walter Hedden in 1929. We usually start out by talking about the chapter and the history and then sort of bring it up to date and what's happening with that now. So today we're talking about Chapter 5. The title of that chapter is Transportation and Terminal Handling of Perishable Food. And we're broadening that a little bit to talk about just transportation infrastructure in general and how it enables our food system.
Exactly. Or sometimes how it gets in the way of our food system. And I think when you and I were planning this episode and talking about some of the sort of contemporary issues and whether they are real, whether they are the same as they were 100 years ago. And the thing I kept thinking about was every time we engage in a conversation with any of our clients about food, no matter who the client is, within the second sentence, I would say, the first sentence is always about trust. The second sentence is about logistics and distribution. It comes up fairly or unfairly as a clearly we can't do without it, right? We
can't. Absolutely. It's unavoidable.
It's unavoidable. Stuff has to get to us. It has to get to cities. It has to get to outlets. It has to get to customers. And the way that that happens is by some mode of transportation bringing it there. And logistics and transportation or distribution are so often chronically and consistently blamed as in lack of, especially when talking about the regional food economy and the regional food system and the really sharp demand of getting regional food, local food into, for example, New York City or really any other city, as our cities are not producing that much food anymore. And as there is this real sort of value system that's built up about regional food and the transportation systems that have kind of followed or got figured out and got built kind of in very much in concert with how the larger, more national supply chains and production chains got built over the course of the last century and a half or so. So it's very much in tune with Hedden's book of him talking about, in fact, the whole point of his writing this book.
Yes.
Was what are we going to do if this rail strike happens in 1926? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen if this rail strike happens? How are we going to get our food? And it really is an echo of what we hear every day at work, which is I'm an institutional catering company and I want to buy local beef, local eggs, local milk. How am I going to get it to my accounts? Or a project that we're working on now, which is the New York State, New York City Regional Food Hubs Task Force, something Governor Cuomo just kind of put his foot down and said, guys, we got to figure this out. How are we going to get this food from New York State to New York City and to other metropolitan areas across the state? It's like, it's time to figure this out. So one thing that occurred to me, which is different than I normally think about it. How I normally think about it is, of course, there's a distribution system, and of course, there are problems with it. And we just need to figure out not the big problem of D, distribution, but the little problem of D. How can this supply chain, this food chain, this value chain get connected with the right agents to bring food from A to B to C and sometimes D?
Yes.
But it occurred to me this week, thinking about this episode and having one of our Food Hub Task Force meetings, that with somebody from the Department of Transportation there of New York State is, you know, there's a system there that is as obscure, and I don't want to say it lacks transparency for any sort of pejorative reason. I don't think it's intentional. It's just there's a system that's been built that's kind of very not sexy, and it involves trucks, and it involves dispatchers, and it involves diesel fuel, and it involves trains and boxes. And, you know, I don't think the general consumer has been particularly interested in that perhaps until now.
Yeah. And it's almost, I don't want to say that it's invisible, but it's not, our attention has not been directed to it, right?
Right. I mean, well, you know, so in that film clip of The Miracle of Feeding Cities, they do a really good job of just in that, you know, in that trailer, just sort of looking for how food gets to and moves around New York City. And I think one of the points I made in the filming of that trailer was, if you look for it, you will see it.
Yeah.
But I think that we haven't needed or wanted to look for it because we just, it just built itself up to satisfy our needs. And like anything else about food, now we're looking into it and asking, what is it? And why is it this way? It's sort of like looking at a label on a packaged food and saying, wow, some of these ingredients I don't really understand. So with distribution and transportation, there's no label, but we kind of want to say, how did this thing get here?
Yeah. And Hedden in his book did that, you know, I think for the first time for the city of New York, right?
To our knowledge. To our knowledge. There are any readers out there who know of any other books that have dealt with this reports, I mean, certainly the U.S. Department of Transportation was probably studying this for a while.
Sure.
So we don't want to kind of put Hedden on too much of a pedestal, but certainly nobody looked at it in this way and quantified the economics of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so as we kind of dive into this topic in the book, I want to revisit a passage from the book that we talked about in an earlier, in our first episode, actually, which is from this chapter, but it's such a like beautiful passage and it really illustrates a lot of what we're doing in this show. Can you guess which passage it is?
I can. I think it's about those wonderful oranges.
It's the oranges. It's always the oranges. And I won't reread the whole thing because we've already read it. And it's kind of long, even though it's beautiful. But what it does is it traces a shipment of oranges from California to New York. And basically, these oranges shoot across the entire continent in just a few days by rail. And then as soon as the shipment hits the New York City metro area, it's very quickly shuttled through something like five different modes of transport. It's like hauled across the river on a barge. There's a hand truck, there's horse carts, there's motor trucks. The point being that like a huge portion of the complexity of this distribution system occurs in that last mile.
Yes. The famous last mile.
And so we'll dig into that topic of the last mile a little bit in more detail later in the episode, as along with some other particular miles of interest along the way. But first, I want to do a little bit of just sort of basic background into the history of food transport over the course of the 20th century. And to help us do that, we got in touch with someone whose work we've admired from afar for quite a while.
I am Nicola Twilley, and I write a blog called Edible Geography and co-host a podcast called Gastropod, and I'm a contributing writer at The New Yorker.
And we'll give this a proper shout out at the end of the episode, but Gastropod is just awesome. We encourage everyone to check it out. But we asked Nicola to tell us about the transition from rail dominance to truck dominance in the transportation infrastructure.
Up until the 1930s, train was still very, you know, rail as a method of food transportation was still very much on top. But based on, I mean, what I've read, what I've put together, it seems to me that sort of the first crack started appearing during when the U.S. joined the First World War in particular, because they started running the railroads and using them to ship munitions and supplies to the war effort. And trucks, which were, you know, really a pretty new phenomenon at that time, and the roads to run them on were even a newer phenomenon, started to pick up some of that slack from the railways sort of being diverted to shipping munitions and so on. So people started to get a taste of trucking at that point, and it really only grew from there. But then, like you say, really, I think it's the 1950s where trucking really takes off, and the thing that really makes it take off is the creation of the interstate system. Suddenly you have this vast network crisscrossing the country, you know, and trucks offer a lot of advantages to be fair to them. I mean, once you have the network in place, for timing purposes, for convenience, for allowing industry to move out of sort of terminal cities into cheaper suburban areas, it's got a lot of charms.
Maybe it's kind of really timely that Nicola applies a word like charm to trucks as kind of illustrating the moment of time we're in when people really want to sort of dig under things and take a look at them. So I think, you know, relative to what I was saying before, sort of, you know, we didn't care what happened. We just care that it's there.
Right.
You know, if you start to look at the different modes of transportation, almost like, I don't know, did you ever have a miniature railroad? What are they called?
Yeah, like kids? a toy railroad.
Yeah, toy railroad. Did you have one?
Model train.
Did you have model trains?
I don't think I did, actually.
I didn't have one either, but boy, did I want one. And because every time I went to my cousin's and played with theirs, I thought it was like so cool. There was a lot of charm. And it was really just sort of fascinating to kind of reroute things and put the different cars together. And so when she used the word charm, I was kind of thinking about that. But it's interesting. I wonder if we apply sort of more personal, emotional sentiments towards the various chains, the various links in the chains of food distribution, that it becomes, if we anthropomorphize these links in the chain, perhaps we can actually get our heads around understanding them.
Yeah, and you know, you had said the distribution structure isn't sexy, but I think maybe it's becoming at least charming, if not sexy,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, I've kind of always thought it was a bit sexy because it was a different kind of sexy, and we're not going to kind of go too deep into that. But, you know, the guys, it is primarily a guy industry.
Right.
The guys behind the distribution, transportation, logistics, brokering, networking of food, they might not be kind of like the cool, hip 21st century idea of sexy, but they have a certain kind of way about them, a certain kind of swagger and bravado that some people can find sexy. And I have certainly enjoyed meeting a lot of them over the years. And our next guest is one of those guys.
And he's going to tell us a little bit about how Hedden's shipment of oranges today would get from California to New York.
Exactly.
My name is Bud Floyd. I spent almost 14 years with a company called C.H. Robinson, who is the largest third-party logistics company, I believe, in the world now, and then retired. I am now a CEO of a software company called Progistics Worldwide, and we are in the supply chain software business. That's what I do. That's who I am.
And we'll actually have Bud on our next episode, too, which is about middlemen. But here he is on oranges.
From the standpoint of the long haul from between California and New York, you've got two ways of going. Today, you've got, obviously, truck, and that would be about a five-day trip. And then you've got rail, and there's a new organization called RailX, which, quite candidly, does just produce from the West Coast. They have a location depot in Fresno, and so that, too, is about a four-day trip, I believe. And that comes into a depot in Pennsylvania. And then from that point, on the RailX side, product is then, based on orders, picked up by retailers or distributed from that point by short-haul truckers into the various locations.
Okay, so that description that Bud gave us of that journey of oranges, aggregated in a depot at one end and distributed from a depot at the other end, is a great setup for our next guest.
My name is Michelle Miller. I work at the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. It's a Sustainable Ag Research Center on the UW-Madison campus.
Michelle told us about the work she's doing around regional supply chains and the challenges of the first mile, the last mile, and what she called the metro mile.
So when we were starting to understand what was going on with the supply chain, there was a lot of talk in transportation about first mile and last mile. And the first mile is where farmers are pulling together product and then aggregating them together at a point of shipment. So that's the first mile. And there's a real need to look at cooperative transportation options for farmers to collect that product. Then the last mile is always the discussion about, you know, how do we get product into a more urban area? How do we, you know, actually make the distributions to the individual retail stores and make sure that consumers have access? But then there's also, as we were studying this issue, we've been noticing that there's also a metro mile. And the metro mile is the area outside the city where congestion starts to create very expensive transportation inefficiencies, where the congestion means that truck flow is coming to a standstill in many cases. The truck drivers don't know how long it's going to take for them to get through traffic, or because of hours of service regulation, can't continue to drive and have to pull over and wait until they can start driving again. So that last mile piece is really a big piece, especially in the last you know, 20 years, this congestion has gotten worse and worse.
And Karen, I know you're all too familiar with that Metro Mile, as you're often traveling between the city and your place on Long Island, where you do farm oysters.
Right. Yeah, you know, all I could think of while she was talking about that Metro Mile is the incredible congestion on the Long Island Expressway and on the Cross Bronx Expressway and on the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, and very often on the New York State Thruway in the final 15 miles or so before it gets to New York City. It's just literally standing still unless you're driving a truck between 1 and 4 in the morning. And the other thing I just want to say about this is, this is also very timely because over the weekend, last weekend, our local paper on the North Fork, which is called the Suffolk Times, had a cover story about the Long Island Expressway extension that never came to be.
Oh, wow.
And for our listeners who also endure the travails of the Long Island Expressway at any time of day or night, and you go out east, either to the Hamptons or to the North Fork, you get to Riverhead, and the expressway literally just stops mm-hmm. at exit. It first kind of stops at exit 71, and then exit 72 and 73 are kind of together, and it just literally dumps you on one of two roads. And I remember growing up, expressly, so to speak, the dynamic and the deliberations that were going on about extending the expressway all the way on the North Fork to the very end, which is kind of an impossible thing to even think about, particularly if you know the geography there at all. The widest point of the North Fork is about 5 miles.
Wow.
And the length is about 22 miles from Riverhead to Orient Point. Actually, it's 30 miles from Riverhead to Orient Point. And the notion that a 4 and now 6 lane road would be barreling through this pastoral landscape is just ridiculous to even try to imagine. However, it reminded me, it called up memories that I had about my father, the real estate broker on the east end of Long Island, dealing with this issue with his farmer customers at that time. So this plan, this grand plan, was going to get approved and rolled out in the 70s. And that I was in my early teens at that time. And my father was a real estate broker dealing exclusively with industrial and farm land on the east end of Long Island and mostly on the North Fork, but not exclusively. And this was like a topic of conversation that he was having all the time that I heard only one end of, which was the end in our house where his office was. And I don't really remember, you know, was he for it? Was he against it? I think he was just trying to mediate the issues with the farmers and the farming community because agriculture out there was certainly on a downward spiral at the time because of many issues, including development pressure, including other regions of the country that were able to ship, grow larger volumes of product and ship them into New York City more effectively, more efficiently, the growing congestion on the Long Island Expressway, a real disenfranchisement between the breadbasket, which the East End of Long Island was for New York City from the middle of the 19th century until the middle of the 20th century, to it not having an economic rationale for that anymore. And it was really good to read that article last weekend because it really told the stories of how the farmers pushed back. Hmm. The Long Island Expressway would literally have bisected many, many farmers' farms. So they would have part of their farm on the north side of the expressway and part of their farm on the south side of the expressway. And they basically said, we're already struggling. It's already hard enough to farm and make a living here. And now you're going to put us out of business. So they literally had that decision. Did they want to get bought out and put out of business, or did they want to stay in business? And they opted to stay in business. And it really was the advocacy of the farmers and the representatives that they had on Long Island that caused that plan to stop. And thank God it did, because now we have a place that, after going through a real, real recession in the late 70s with the fuel crisis and a recession, deep recession in the late 70s, as the wine industry brought the East End agriculture sector into a new era and into a new life, the other farms there have started to rebound, the fruit and vegetable, particularly vegetable production, and now even early signs of a reviving animal agriculture sector, albeit very small, but actually figuring out a way to make it work. So, yeah, transportation's been kind of part of my family legacy, I guess.
Yeah.
It's relatively easy to move product from California to Chicago. But once you hit that barrier, that metro mile, suddenly it's so time-consuming and energy-consuming, it's completely inefficient. And it's inefficient not only from the point of view of the cost of fuel to the company and the cost of labor to the company, but also for the cost of the greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important to address those issues.
There's also something here about how the system is optimized, or for whom, or for what it is optimized, or for who it was built. I don't think it's controversial to say that our food distribution infrastructure, as it now exists, as it currently stands, isn't really built for small-scale producers or local and regional supply chains. Here's Nicola again.
Everything from, the interstate system, for example, to containerization has sort of push this in that direction of scaling up and doing it for the cheapest possible price and for cheap foods for Americans, for export, for all of that. So that works very well. What doesn't work very well is if you don't want to operate at that scale. And that's where the local and regional food movements have had such a challenge. It works really well for a specialist system. You have a grain belt. That grain belt is supplying a national and international food supply, and the infrastructure is gauged accordingly. It just then doesn't have a lot of flexibility to work at other scales.
Karen, a lot of our work over the years has been around local and regional supply chains. What are some of the main challenges that you've seen as those relate to transportation and distribution infrastructure?
Sure. And how have those challenges evolved? What's the conversation now about those same things? So as I mentioned earlier, when we started to get involved in regional food economies and regional food system work, it was really to answer that question. How do we get more regional food to New York City? There is the moan, and justifiable moan was there's no distribution system set up for this. So I think that really echoes what Nicola told us, and again, I wasn't accepting that as a pat answer, because after all, there are trucks on the roads all the time. There's trains. There's even a waterway. So we have really spent a lot of the last 13 years with the belief that there has to be a system that exists. How can we identify it? How can we locate it? And how can we make it work for our clients that want to be making these wholesale connections for regional food, albeit at a much smaller scale than the product coming in from afar?
So vertical integration is all about who owns what in the supply chain. And as the ownership builds under one company, multiple places in the supply chain, they can absorb inefficiencies in one area with efficiencies in another. If you're a small business working in only one piece of the supply chain and you're looking for other small businesses to create linkages with, then you've got to have relationships that are based on trust and openness and fairness so that everyone in the supply chain benefits. And that's very hard to do. So I think vertical integration was an attempt to try to build those efficiencies across the chain by owning the whole chain. What that's meant is that we've ended up with food access issues in urban areas where we need small businesses to come in and serve that community, do the service piece of business, but they aren't able to do so because the ownership structure doesn't allow it. So if you're a small business in downtown Chicago, say, and you want to buy some fruits and vegetables for your grocery store to serve your neighborhood, you end up going to Walmart to purchase that stuff and then selling it at a markup in your store because there's nowhere else to purchase the product from. No wholesale opportunity.
What Michelle just spoke about pinpoints precisely the issue that we have for both regional food producers and the distribution system or systems they use, which is often self-operated, meaning they drive their own trucks, and also for the small businesses that are scattered throughout cities, New York, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, Louisville, even Miami, Houston, Dallas, et cetera, which are the smaller businesses actually want to buy smaller quantities of more regionally produced foods.
Right.
They actually need to buy smaller quantities of everything. And given the huge growth and evolution of cities and the complicated transportation networks within those cities, it has been taking those small businesses longer and longer, even if they're a small distribution business, to go out to the terminal market, load up a truck, smaller truck, and do that last mile of distribution, whether it be to themselves or to other small businesses.
Right. And you're talking about the growth of cities. And as our cities grow, that's also changing the landscape of where our food is coming from and, of course, how it gets to us.
If we've got, you know, uncontrolled sprawl in our metro regions, basically eating up the available farmland, and we're going to have to take more and more product from far away and bring it into the city, that's problematic. We've also got issues where we've got a high demand for local food, but we don't have enough local food because farmers aren't paid enough to grow local food to make it worth their while to serve those urban markets. And so that's all. There's also a serious tension around price and labor for providing local food.
You know, she's right. These are big, complicated problems that are now getting more attention or consideration for a number of reasons, including the increased interest in regional supply chains and how they're being looked at to appropriately or inappropriately become a solution for our nation's health crisis, but also really being looked at in the context and framework of a city's resiliency.
Right.
And resiliency on many different levels. I mean, we are being asked, actually, in this Food Hubs work that we're doing now, to really create very clear definitions of what we mean by resiliency or elaborate on the context of resiliency. And so resiliency has so many contexts when it comes to distribution systems for food. One is, we need these systems to work no matter what, meaning we need the terminal markets, we need the hubs, we need the distributors, warehouses, all to be functioning for as much time as possible, even when there's a disaster, whether it be a security breach like 9/11, whether it be a more climate-related natural disaster like Hurricane Sandy. In both of these cases, we found that the good idea that was to designate the Hunts Point Peninsula as New York City's food distribution zone is still a really good idea, but it is not the only idea.
Right.
The city's become so big that small distributors can't get there just on a daily basis. But when there is a disruption, such as the ones I mentioned, they can't get there at all.
Right.
And so what happens to the small neighborhoods that are furthest away from these central distribution hubs? Mm-hmm. There need to be smaller distribution outlets in these places, not as backup, but just as part of a rebuilt network of warehouse distribution hubs.
Yeah. So these sort of concerns about resiliency and concerns about serving and accommodating smaller supply chains are really what are driving a lot of the innovations that are happening right now in the distribution infrastructure. And our favorite part of every episode is sort of like where we ask our guests what's happening in the future, like what's like, where is this going? And so, you know, we asked our guests today what some of the innovations are that they're seeing to improve our food distribution systems. Bud talked about containers and traceability.
I believe that as time goes on, we'll get better and better at managing the assets within the supply chain. So, for instance, if you look at the containers that are stacked up there in Newark, annually the container community spends $16 billion a year just in moving those containers to a point where they'll be utilized. So, and in many instances, or pallets, you know, a number of retailers and obviously manufacturers have thousands and thousands of dollars of CHIP or IFCO pallets on the floor that are not being utilized. So one of the areas I believe is that the supply chain will become much more efficient from the standpoint of utilization of hard assets. It could be trucks, it could be containers, it could be pallets, it could be RPCs, it could be any of those things. And I think that will help with the whole cost structure. So that's one piece. I think also, as it relates to technology, the traceability piece, so that if at some point in time I know the lot in the field that product came from and subsequently know how it was maintained and treated all the way to the store where it went to, then when I have a tomato recall or a cantaloupe recall, I can go to that dot on the map and not recall all the tomatoes on the East Coast.
Exactly.
Which would be a significant savings.
And Michelle talked about things they're working on to address the specific challenges of the first mile, the metro mile, and the last mile.
We're looking at three innovations to address each of those three parts of the chain, of the supply chain. So with the first mile, we're really looking at cooperative logistics. Back in the 60s, dairy co-ops started to look at what it would take to create cooperative logistics between dairy farms and their creameries to make transportation more efficient. And so we think that can be done in many other industries, including vegetable production, maybe meat production, those kinds of other pieces of the food supply chain. Then at the last mile, we think the addition of public wholesale markets is really key. That if we really want to improve transportation efficiencies for those small businesses that are really community-based and community-owned, they're going to need a wholesale market opportunity so that they can pull product into their community. And then the third one would be the metro mile. And this is the area that I think has had the least amount of attention, mostly because it's very business-facing. There's not a lot of consumer-facing here. And the idea there is to essentially make freight trucks multimodal. So rather than having one kind of truck that's basically a jack-of-all-trades, start making it possible, putting in the infrastructure so that trucks can be multimodal. So if they're traveling long distances, they have a certain design. If they're traveling through that metro market, that they have a different design. One of the efficiencies that could be adopted in that kind of scenario is that we could start having freight trucks that are moving food using alternative fuels, for instance, because it's possible to refuel in those short distances, whereas in the long distances, it's not.
Michelle's comments remind me of some of the things that Robin talked about in our very first episode as well.
Right.
Are there going to be drones doing the last mile distribution in cities? Are there going to be electric cars? Are there going to be light rails going in and among the cities? And I hope, except for the drones, I kind of hope that all those other things do happen. I'm not down with the drone thing yet, because we also need to make sure that the people in our cities are employed, and
sure.
and I think actually handling food is still really important. Anyway, but the notion that there'd be a newly built nervous system of small capillaries and blood flows of folks and businesses that are, and perhaps municipal services that are making this metro mile and last mile more possible, is certainly very interesting. And I know you have some things to say about design, but one of the things I was thinking about truck design is, you know, what if there were like those Russian dolls? Like, what if trucks actually had smaller and smaller compartments built into them, and they could just fall out and go on a rail, fall out and go on a smaller truck, and just become a very compartmentalized system. It's one of the ways, I think, with our current infrastructure and the current paradigm of rail and trucks and not yet the next great thing, that somebody could figure out from a design perspective.
Absolutely. And Nicola made the great point that effective innovations are not going to be cookie cutter. They need to respond to the environment that they're applied to.
You need a very specific place-based solution, as opposed to sort of the giant, you know, grain farm that we might be talking about, where the same solution will work for that as will work for a giant grain farm in Argentina. You know, it's not. Mm-hmm. So it becomes less of a one-size-fits-all solution. The urban environment is different everywhere, so it's a little bit about looking at what New York offers that we're not using yet. And in New York, I always feel like the water is the most neglected thing. It's a bunch of islands, and no one gets out on the water ever unless they take the Staten Island Ferry.
And Karen, some of our past work has looked at water transport. Do you think water could be the future of food transport, or is it a dead end?
I don't think it's either one of those things. Certainly water was a really important part of our past food transport, and some of the reasons that got usurped is because of national supply chains that could get us perishable food as quickly or quicker and certainly cheaper. Also because of some of the sort of downsizing of regional supply chains. And what has happened over the last century because of the cost of fuel and the disparate nature of rail for food transport, truck is king. Mm-hmm. And it's the cheapest, most individualized, most flexible way to get food from A to B.
It has that charm.
Is that the charm?
The charm of the flexibility.
The charm of the... Yes, that's funny. As you just mentioned, we did do this study that was funded by NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Resource something or other. We'll have to figure out what that is. But NYSERDA funded a study to look at barge transport and how it could become relevant again. And while at the time I was highly suspicious of how it could be realistic, since we've completed that project and by the way, we determined it wasn't realistic in the current economic paradigm, I think that waterways will again become part of some transportation system, possibly mimicking the efficiencies and some of the technology that have been created for global transport of ships and shipping containers. Not that we'll have great gigantic shipping containers going across the Erie Canal, but that we can learn something from that system and be ready for it when the cost of fuel is too high.
Yeah.
What's so interesting about all of these things is that the economics have to be right, because when the Erie Canal was first built, everyone reoriented around it as quick as could be because it offered such an economic advantage
right.
to get your product to market for literally a tenth of the price.
Right.
If the economic incentive is there, people will turn their distribution method and reorient their farms as quick as you like. It is not impossible. It's simply a matter of what's the economics telling you to do. And in a society where we are actually subsidizing road transportation, it's not surprising that the economics lean in that direction.
Okay, it's simply a matter of what's the economics telling you to do. In a society where we are actually subsidizing road transportation, it's not surprising that the economics lean in that direction.
True, just what we said before. And I think one of the things that I'm thinking about in wrapping up this episode is I'm hoping that maybe this episode could be a real thing to give to people that are really trying to figure this out as a way to instigate a conversation about transportation and get it out of the brains of the people who know about it, put it in the hand of the assistant commissioner I met on Wednesday and say, hey, can we have a conversation about this?
Absolutely. And I think the economics are starting to change a little bit. I mean, there's so much demand for local and regional foods now that, like, that's why this ball is starting to roll a little bit.
The moment is here.
Excellent. So just a quick thanks to our guests for today, Nicola Twilley. Check out her podcast, Gastropod, at gastropod.com. Michelle Miller at the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at the University of Wisconsin. If you want to check that out, that is cias.wisc.edu. And then also a quick shout out to Open House New York. They have this amazing series going on for the next year called The Final Mile. They are at ohny.org. The kickoff for that series was a talk that Karen gave, conversation with Robert LaValva. The name of the lecture was How Great Cities Are Fed. We talk about this episode and a lot of the same topics, so you can check that out on the Heritage Radio website, heritageradionetwork.org. And we'll talk to you next time for our next episode, which is about who are the middlemen. For heritageradionetwork.org, I'm Ben Carrick.
And Karen Karp.
See you next month.